Blog Talk Radio. Good evening, everybody, listening into the Wise Women Media, the radio show on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Anita Stewart, and we have interesting topics, and just remember, this is just a conversation. I wanted to note our sponsors, which are Roundtree 7, Here Be Monsters, Daughters of Isis, The Hoodoo Blog, Power New Media and Public Relations, Tarot and Stars, Florida Nature Photos, And I also want to invite you all to check us out on the web at wisewomenmedia.posteris.com and hit us up at the WePay link so we can keep the show on the air every week. This date is significant because everything is relative, but December 7th marks the Memorial Day of the attack on Pearl Harbor, which was the incident that really got the United States involved in the Second World War. There's a lot of theories as to why that happened and how that happened and how it probably was World War II's 9/11 incident. But what was significant that happened afterwards, of course, was not only the United States becoming involved in the Second World War, but some of the first uses of nuclear energy, but in a very malefic way by our military bombing Nagasaki and Hiroshima later on during the war in August of 1945. So we are going to talk tonight about how nuclear energy is being used as a power source and how that is probably definitely not a good idea. We have a special guest with us from the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, or SACE, S-A-C-E, Mandy Hancock, who's a high-risk energy organizer. And are you on the air with us, Mandy?
I am, Anita. Hi, how are you?
Well, great, and thanks for being on the show tonight. I wanted you to maybe start out about telling us a little bit about how you got involved in regards to your advocacy against nuclear energy and how you got this position and exactly what this position entails. So I'm going to give you the...
Okay. Well, I got involved in advocacy and activism and energy work while I was on campus at Valdosta State University in South Georgia. And I got involved with the Southern Energy Network, which is SACE's campus program. And I was there, just a volunteer for a while and organizing on campus. And once I graduated, I went after their Florida organizer position. And when I got that position, I sort of inherited the nuclear issue. And I didn't at that time know very much about it. I had seen a talk by Mary Olson in South Carolina at the Southeast Student Renewable Energy Conference, and she had this big map that had all of the nuclear stuff that was going on in the United States, including all of the reactors that were operating and all of the ones that were proposed and all of the waste sites, and I just saw the Southeast, my home region, smothered in nuclear mess is basically how I saw it. And so I was interested in the issue, but I didn't really have a strong connection at that time. I wasn't even aware that they were proposing to build two new ones in Georgia at that time, you know. And when I moved to Florida to take on my new role as the Florida organizer, I sort of inherited the issue. Some students and Mary Olson had already started a sort of statewide loosely associated network of people that were discussing what was happening at the state level, and I started facilitating that conversation and then just decided I would really rather focus just on nuclear work because I was doing a lot of student organizing at the time that had me doing much larger national type campaigns. And I talked to some folks and we all worked it out and we carved out a part-time position for me to just work on nuclear, and it slowly built up to almost full-time so that I can spend a lot of time working on Florida, but I also do some work in Georgia and Tennessee, and I do some liaison work in the Carolinas as far as keeping them up with what's happening in Florida, and it's really interesting, keeps me on my toes.
Well, that's great that you were able to actually put that position together, but definitely it's an information source, and it's definitely a powerhouse for getting information out there to the activist community, because we can certainly talk about how the media hides a lot of these facts about nuclear energy and nuclear power, and how really the masses have been just cajoled into believing that it's a veritable form of energy, it's legitimate, it's safe, it's clean. And as you and I know, that nothing could be further from the truth. And just
right.
So the audience knows, Mandy and I met each other with Mary Olson from NERS at a teach-in. I think we were up in Marion County, weren't we? It was back a couple winters ago.
We were out in the woods somewhere.
Really a cool,
very near
cool.
the proposed Levy County site. We were and we were at the edge of a couple of county boundaries. I believe that it was very close to the proposed Levy site in Georgia, in Florida.
And nothing could have been more pristine being out there. I mean, to think that if we had been out there and it had been later in time, or you know, situation had been different, and a nuclear power plant could have been maybe just a few miles away, it would have been really, really a horrible thing to think about. So, but I was able to learn a lot on that particular weekend. Tell us a little bit about what's happening with the Levy County plant, because I think a lot of people want to hear about that, and I really do feel that a lot of the facts are covered up. So give us a little information, especially about how we can follow the money trail to find out what's really going on.
Well, that is a little trickier, especially with the merger with Progress Energy and Duke Energy. It's a little bit trickier to follow the money, and I guess we're still kind of looking to see what's going to happen with some of the recent developments with that situation. I can say that North Carolina has been a lot more on the tail of this Duke Progress Energy merger situation than the Florida Commission has been following it. But with the Levy reactors, so there's several things that are unique about the Levy County situation. And one is that they are proposed to be built on a greenfield site. Any of the other new reactor proposals in the country are all proposed in existing reactor sites. And so this is a very ecologically sensitive area that we're talking about. It's right by the Gothy National Forest, and it's sitting over the top of an aquifer that supplies the water to a lot of the beautiful springs in our part of the state, and it's just a very ecologically sensitive area. And so the Mary Olson and Nuclear Information Resource Service and the Ecology Party of Florida banded together to intervene on the license for the Levy reactors. And it's a long, drawn-out, convoluted process with the regulatory body, sort of like dealing with any bureaucracy. It takes a long, long time for anything to happen. So that process has been going on since 2009, and we just recently had another hearing in Bronson, Florida, at the Levy County Courthouse. And we got to hear the geologists from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the geologists from that were hired by the interveners, discussing some of the primary concerns that were actually accepted by the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board as being relevant and significant enough to hold the proceedings and to examine further. And that's basically a water contention that deals with the water quality and quantity in the area. Since there are a lot of wetlands in the area, Dr. Sidney Backus is the intervener's expert, and she did all of her doctoral dissertation work on the wetlands in that very specific area that they're talking about building the nuclear reactors. And what she found was that there was a lot of opportunity for the drawback from the water that they want to pull from the aquifer to damage those wetlands, and that's obviously a problem because wetlands are protected for very good reason. And in Florida, we have a very long history of what can go wrong problem when you don't protect the wetlands as you should. So it's a big deal. And what we found through those proceedings was that the research that was done wasn't really done in the area where they want to build the wells and draw the water out of the aquifer. They just looked at what would happen at the area basically where the nuclear reactors were going to be. They call it the nuclear island. So we went through this long two-day proceeding basically to find out that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff had just used a model and extrapolated some data and then used that modeling to determine what would happen in that area without actually drawing any core samples or any real tangible physical data from the area. And my favorite part of that proceeding was when the presiding judge, Carlin, said, well, is it better to have information from a model or is it better to have information from real life? And they got a chuckle out of the people in the courtroom, but it's really not funny because the truth of the matter is that real life data is something that you can't replace with a model. And all of the information that they were using to base their decisions on were based on a model that had been edited and reevaluated and recalibrated a couple of times because it wasn't up to snuff even for the NRC. So it's a really tricky thing. It's hard to really package up in a neat nutshell, but the long and the short of it is I think that we won that case in front of the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, but it'll be obviously up to them to make the decision as to whether or not our case was strong enough to make the NRC go back and redo that portion of the environmental impact statement. Other than that, with the Levy reactors, that's really the only thing happening on the legal side to prevent it other than the stuff that's happening at the state level with the nuclear cost recovery legislation.
You talk about the environmental impact statement, and of course it is theories, but it reminds me of what they did during the Gulf oil spill when they simply pulled something from that they had after the Exxon Valdez disaster, and they used this, you know, huge document, which was an environmental impact statement for, of course, you know, Alaska, and mm-hmm. what was they were applying it to the Gulf of Mexico, and then somebody noticed on page 500 or whatever, there was a listing of animals, and of course, walrus were included. It was like,
oh, goodness.
Wait a minute, this is not the environmental impact statement for the Gulf of Mexico. It can't be. So,
oh,
you know,
gosh.
But they're, like you said, they extrapolate data that may or may not apply to what they're actually dealing with at the time. It's really crazy. But tell us a little bit about the cost and the recovery and the money and how that is coming into play now, because that's the big thing in the nutshell here.
Yeah, and that is the thing that is getting the most attention, and the cost is, the short way to say it is the cost is exorbitant, and it certainly is. When they initially proposed the reactors, they were proposed to cost about half what they're proposed to cost now, and they were supposed to come online in the late 2010s, and now they've been pushed out to the late 2020s. And so essentially back in 2006, the state legislature passed an energy bill that had this sneaky little amendment in it that became the basis for this nuclear cost recovery legislation. And we call it the nuclear tax because that's essentially what it is a tax. It's being levied by Progress Energy and Florida Power and Light to subsidize the cost that they're putting into these nuclear projects. And the reason they're doing that is because it makes good business sense, because right now the Wall Street and the investors, they know that these are very risky business decisions, and they won't really touch them. We always say Wall Street won't touch it, and that's true. They won't finance these type projects because the risk of them defaulting is really high. And so the only way that the utilities can make these nuclear projects a feasible reality is to subsidize all of the risk onto their customers. And so basically what they're doing is privatizing the profit and socializing the risk. And so ever since 2009, when the first nuclear cost recovery increase was actually began on the bills, Progress Energy customers and Florida Power and Light customers have been paying money for new nuclear reactors. For Progress, part of that money went towards Crystal River because it was supposed to be an upgrade.
Right.
But I believe that I'm not sure how much of the money went towards Crystal River, and obviously we can get into a little bit of that mess, but they're not getting any bang for that buck because that reactor's been broken for 3 years. So far they've been approved for over $1 billion. The Public Service Commission and that's both of the utilities, Progress and Florida Power and Light, the Public Service Commission just approved another $292 million. So that brings the total up to almost $1.3 billion that has been approved for these projects that may or may not ever happen. And if these reactors are never built, the customers don't get a refund. So it's a very tricky spot for the consumers to be in, that's for sure.
And some of the customers, I mean, when you look at it in that regard, some of those customers will be dead. So they'll never even...
Absolutely. And that point has been made multiple times. I've heard it being made at the Public Service Commission. There's been some mention of it when we were at the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board hearing. It was interesting that the topic came up because really it was outside of the scope of what that hearing was about, but it was brought up. And they discuss it as sort of like an intergenerational burden. And some people say, well, you know, of course that's how it is. You know, people pay taxes for roads that they're not ever going to drive on. You know, that's how it works. But that is a little bit different. There's something that is actually promised to come into fruition from that money, whereas in this situation, it's a corporate project that doesn't have any guarantees. So, you know, it doesn't really matter how you package it. It's not a good deal for Florida consumers. And what it really does is it creates an unlevel playing field where real solutions to our energy problems can't be pursued because all of our time and money is being wrapped up in these big, expensive, complicated nuclear projects, and we're ignoring some of the low-hanging fruit that's right in front of us, which is increasing our efficiency and exploring renewable projects, perhaps going for some solar in the Sunshine State. It sounds so nice. It rolls off the tongue very well.
Yeah, and it makes perfect sense that if we're called the Sunshine State, that we would utilize the power that's the most abundant here. You know, I mean, I'm looking and we have some people in the chat room, and I'm hoping that any of you, if you've got any questions, just dash them off there in the chat room. And also, if you prefer to call and ask Mandy any questions, our call-in number is 213-816-0357. I wanted to talk about, you know, you can take this a step further, and I wanted to make this point before we go further, or I'm going to forget it. Our leaders vote on this. Our power companies have basically usurped their power. So we, the people that are paying these power bills, are paying a tax without representation. We are being taxed without representation for a service that we may or may not see in the future. So I'm not understanding, and I cannot quite wrap my mind around the fact that people are not enraged over this. I mean, this is something that people should just be in the streets over.
Well, there's certainly more upset about it than they were in the past. When I first started doing this in 08, you know, when you'd see an article come out, they were never very hard-hitting, and the comments were, well, we need nuclear because coal is bad, and, you know, the analysis just really wasn't very deep. And I can say that in the 4 years since that, you know, you see where there may have been 3 comments before, now there's 47 comments, and people are outraged. It's maybe not always enough to get them to take to the streets, but I think it did have people really tuning in to the Public Service Commission hearings this year and tuning in to the Supreme Court case that SACE is involved in, where we're challenging the constitutionality of this this legislation because it is an unfair tax. And basically the part of the meat, let's say, of that sort, that case is basically that the legislature is given the Public Service Commission unbridled discretion to make these decisions without really giving them the definitions they need to make smart decisions. So the law basically says, oh, well, they can recover prudently incurred costs. But there's no definition of what prudent is. There's no real, there's not the same standard that is usually applied in rate cases is not being applied here. And most rate cases are subject to public commenting and that sort of thing, whereas these rate cases are not. The public can go and they can watch the proceedings, but they aren't able to make any comments except via online, and who knows where those things go. They get put on in a file that's really difficult to find on the PSC website, but I think that's where they go to just collect dust. I'm unsure if anyone ever sees them again. So
I wanted to pull out just a little.
I'm sorry,
you know,
Anita.
They need a letter, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to pull out a piece of what you said, how this happens with the money and the power, and then the people just basically are getting the raw end of the deal. So after the public service, after the Supreme Court case hearings, they heard oral arguments at the beginning of October, and that following weekend, the Southeastern Renewable Energy Conference that I referenced earlier, which is where I initially got my exposure to the nuclear issue, was hosted in Tallahassee. And so part of the conference always involves an action component. And their messaging this year was getting dirty politics out of money, getting dirty politics. That was the Freudian slip, getting dirty money out of politics and cleaning up the dirty South, and they were using the nuclear cost recovery issue as the local example of what can go wrong when dirty money is influencing the politics, because basically the utilities had all these lobbyists. I can't even remember how many it was per legislator in Florida, and they just flooded Tallahassee with all this money, and they wanted this bill to be owned. We need to diversify our portfolio, and we need fuel diversification and energy independence and all of this stuff, and they made it sound like we needed it, and we're going to run out of power and all of this stuff. And so the amendment got snuck in. Nobody really asked any questions. And as soon as people realized what happened, you know, everybody voted for it. There was only one person that voted against it. And she said, I can't remember her name right now, which is very unfortunate. I'd love to give her credit. She said the reason she voted against it because she read the bill. And it was horrible, you know. So that's what happens when dirty money influences politics. And then you see years later, the people are finally waking up to what's happening and the fact that their bills are only going to continue to go up, and they're going to be stuck footing the bill for these phantom, I've been calling them phantom nuclear reactors, because we don't really know if they'll ever exist.
Right. I call all money in politics dirty. I think it's all dirty because, of course, I've support moved to amend in the abolishment, you know, complete abolishment of corporate personhood. And I think as soon as we take the ability of our legislators to be bought away from them, then we'll have some true representation. But right now we don't have it. And like you said, most of our legislators do not read the bills. The lobbyists write them. And the legislatures might scan them or have their assistants scan them, and then they sign off on them before even realizing what they say. So they are completely bought and paid for by the corporations, and until we can divide those two, we're just going to have more and more of this. I wanted to note a most recent article about the Levy County situation. It was an article that came out in the Tampa Bay Times. Have you read this, Mandy? It's called Florida House Representative Files Bill to Repeal Advance Fee for Building Nuclear Plants. It just came out yesterday.
This with Ray Winkle-Vasalinda, right?
That's it. Yes, that's it. She's listed here. It says State Representative Michelle Rawinkle-Vasalinda, Democrat from Tallahassee, who described the advance fee as an unfair tax, in quotes, said a growing coalition of lawmakers support the bill she filed. So great. So maybe she's actually passing it around and getting people, you know, getting other lawmakers to actually, you know, support it. But in any case, I have posted that link under our blog post at Wise Women Media. So anybody that wants to go directly to that link, it's at the very bottom. So now that we've kind of discussed in short a little bit about Levy County, give us just a little rundown on what you know about Crystal River, which is really closer to Tampa and really, I think it really puts us under the gun, especially if there's ever a hurricane. But tell us a little bit about Crystal River and where we're at with that. It's broken, but a lot of people might not even know that it's broken and not functional.
Well, it's been broken for 3 years, and so Progress Energy wanted to do what Florida Power and Light did with St. Lucie. They uprated it so that it would put out more power than it already was already producing. And so what they did is they hired an outside firm and went against some advice that they had to perhaps consult with someone who had done this type of project before and to not do it themselves. And they did it themselves anyway and went against their engineering consultant's advice and started deconstructing the containment unit in such a way that they had been made aware that this was a dangerous way to deconstruct the containment building to get in there and replace the steam generator to upgrade it. And they did it exactly the opposite of the way they were told to do it, and they broke it. And the first few media pieces seem to allude that they found these cracks, what they called delamination. You know, they like to use euphemistic language so people don't really know what's happening, because cracks in a nuclear containment vessel sounds way worse than delamination, which no one really even knows what that means. And so they broke it, and they say that the work that they did is what created the cracks. It's hard to say. The cracks could have already been there. They wouldn't know because they couldn't see it. So they went in to fix it, and it happened again, and they went in to fix it, it happened again. So basically they've broken it 3 times, and it's rapidly coming up close to Three Mile Island as being one of the most expensive nuclear accidents in the U.S. The difference, of course, here is that no radiation was released, whereas in Three Mile Island there was. So customers were on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars in replaced fuel charges because Progress was having to import energy in from other places in the grid to make up for that loss. Their customers did get most of that money back earlier this year with the stipulation that Progress Energy had to make a decision as to whether or not they were going to fix Crystal River or not, and they were supposed to make that decision by the end of the year. So it's rapidly running out, and they may be due to give another refund to their customers, or perhaps that just happened last week. I know they did reach another settlement agreement, and I think it was related to Crystal River. The long and the short of it is that we've been calling it the Humpty Dumpty reactor because it's it's fallen apart, and they just can't seem to put it back together again. It doesn't matter how much money they throw at it. Right now, estimates are that it will be $3 billion in the end to get it operating again, and that's about how much the thing cost to begin with. So $3 billion to get a really old reactor that's nearing the end of its license working again. Doesn't seem like a very smart investment, but we'll see what Duke/Progress decides to do with that.
Now, one of the most recent articles that came out about that was December 1st, and it came out in TBO.com, and the title of it was Fasano, who is a local legislator, Fasano critical of nuclear power fee. And the caption under the picture on that article, again, I'll post the link under the blog post for this show. It says, Progress Energy customers pay an extra $1.93 on monthly bills for a nuclear fee that was approved by the legislature in 2006. The fee was implemented to collect $142 million to help fund the Crystal River and proposed Levy County nuclear power plants shown in a rendering above. So this is still an ongoing story, and of course this I'm just scanning through this article here, and it's talking a little bit about the money and what Progress Energy customers are paying. There's a quote here by Fasano who says, it's a joke. He said they make money whether they build nuclear power plants or not. And he said, Fasano argues that company stockholders should bear development expenses, not customers, before a plant goes into operation. And then the article does end with exactly what you said, Mandy, that, you know, the end of this license will be December of 2016, and it's a 35-year-old nuclear reactor. So, again, you know, why can't it be out with the old and in with the new? And that's the real question here.
That's a good question. And they'll face a little bit more trouble than a lot of the other relicensing reactors have faced. So far, it's been like a rubber stamp. Every reactor that puts in for a license extension gets 20 years. Okay, there you go. Here's another 20 years to run your reactor. And very often, right after they get approved, something happens, like when Oyster Creek is one of the oldest operating reactors, and that's up in New Jersey. Right after they approved its relicensing was when they found tritium leaking out of it. Right before the Vermont Yankee reactor was relicensed, they found tritium leaking under it. And now that state is being sued by an out-of-town nuclear operator or out-of-state nuclear operator because the state says, the state ruled, it's one of the only states that has the authority to deny operator the right to operate in their state. And so this Louisiana-based utility is suing the state of Vermont because Vermont says, no, you can't operate the reactor, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says, sure, you can. But Vermont says, no, you guys lied to us. You know, there's no way we're going to let you continue to operate this reactor when you've been threatening our drinking water and all this kind of stuff. So the relicensing situation has been interesting to watch. But ever since the waste confidence ruling happened, I'm not sure if you have been following that, but that's going to grind the gears to a halt as far as relicensing and licensing activities go.
There's a question in the chat room, which is kind of interesting, and actually the question comes from my sister, and she says, I work for independent supply companies that buy energy for deregulated utilities in 11 states. What about them? I'm not sure what she means specifically, but maybe you know.
Well, I don't know what she means. I can say that some of the deregulated utilities are buying into these projects. So Jacksonville Electric is buying into, I think, Turkey Point and the Vogtle reactors in Georgia. And in Georgia, there's a nuclear energy consortium sort of that's formed with Southern Company, which is Georgia Power, and some of the smaller municipal utilities have joined together. And so it really just depends on the state how those guys factor in. In Florida, so far Progress Energy has not found any partners, and I think that I'm not sure who all is buying into the Turkey Point project yet, because it's not really as far along as the Levy County project. They haven't really done a whole lot on the Turkey Point licensing yet. So without knowing what she means specifically as far as what about those guys, I don't really know
she
what
else. She said
they,
do. They are brokers that buy energy for the utilities.
Mm-hmm.
So my sister actually works in a call center, so that's what she's doing on the phone is she's working those little things for the dealers, the brokers, I guess. So there you go.
Well, folks like her are helping Progress Energy keep the lights on in their territory with the fact that Crystal River Light is down, because that's what Progress has been having to do is buy power from other utilities, and so I'm sure that they're working through folks like your sister to make that happen.
So it's like a reselling back and forth, basically. It's just
mm-hmm.
a re-slamming. Remember back in the day when you'd telemarket, if you were telemarketing, you'd be calling and slamming people for phone service, and they were just yanking service back and forth from this carrier to the next carrier to the next carrier, and it would go on and on. So I guess this is pretty much the same thing. So,
well, it's more of a, like, if they have excess power, who are they going to sell it to? And if they're lacking power, who are they going to buy it from? So it's sort of, you know, making up where they need extra and then selling off where they're producing extra. And I'm sure that they have to negotiate that to who's going to get that extra, who's going to supply where there's a lack in energy.
And I keep thinking about right before the housing bubble, how everybody was flipping houses. And basically, it's the same principle. So tell me a little bit about Turkey Point. That is interesting to me, and I will tell you why that location is interesting to me. I have an old article from a Miami Herald, which shows after Hurricane Andrew, one of the stacks coming down being intentionally pulled down, and it sustained millions and millions of dollars worth of damages. Yet people insisted during that time after Andrew, and well, during the storm itself and afterwards, that there was no radiation release. And frankly, I kind of find that hard to believe if one smokestack was actually intentionally pulled and millions were spent in redoing it. So tell us a little bit about what's happening with Turkey Point, if you have any, you know, information on it.
Sure. SACE is actually one of the intervening parties on that license, so we're intervening in the licensing of that reactor. I'm not familiar. I don't know right now where we stand as far as what contentions may have been submitted or not. So I can't give an update in that regard, but I can say that it may not be on a greenfield site like Levy is, but that doesn't mean it's any less of a mess, because this would be Turkey Point 6 and 7, which means there's already 5 power generating units at that site. Two of them are nuclear reactors, and there's some coal and combined cycle happening down there. And it's situated right in between Biscayne Bay and the Everglades, which are two national parks, the Everglades being one of the most expensive restoration projects that's ever happened in this country. And Biscayne Bay is another ecologically sensitive area. And basically, they want to build those two. They're sort of dragging their feet. They're focusing a lot more right now on uprating their existing reactors. So they've increased the output of St. Lucie. They're increasing the output of the two existing Turkey Point reactors. And they haven't really put a whole lot of money towards the new reactors yet. But there are obviously a lot of concerns. And one of them, of course, which we've mentioned a little bit in regards to Levy, and that's the water issue. Nuclear reactors take a lot of water, and while they're going to be pulling most of the cooling water from, well, there's a couple of different ways they have proposed to do it. One is by treated wastewater, and it remains to be seen whether or not they'll actually be able to do that, because some of the laws that were making it seem like there would be an excess of treated wastewater, you know, there were some laws about going on about municipalities and treating wastewater and preventing some more wastewater from going into the ocean. Some of the laws that were instituted there have gotten like delays because municipalities didn't have the money to do what they had to do to make that happen. So the, it may not be that the wastewater they thought was going to be there is going to be available. So one of their other plans is to put these big giant radial wells in Biscayne Bay to just suck up, a hundred million gallons of water a day, essentially, is how much it usually takes to operate two reactors, at least 70 million, 80 million for the two reactors. So one of the things that stands out to me about the Turkey Point situation in regards to water is in the environmental impact statement, and I read this thing a couple of years ago, and Florida Power and Light has a chart in there that looks at the projected water increase from that point until, I think it was 2025, it may have been 2035. So I'm not sure about the time frame, but I know the numbers for sure. And they said that for residential and commercial use, they were expecting a 35% increase for residential and commercial. That's for all of the Miami-Dade area, 35% for all the people and all the business. And then for thermoelectric power generation, they said 3,224% increase. Wow, that's a lot. That is an unbelievable amount that they're expecting, an increase for thermoelectric power generation. And as it stands right now, the only new plants that are proposed in the Miami-Dade area are Turkey Point. So you're telling me that, it's like a 100-fold increase over what the people are going to need to do their business and live. So I don't know that that's necessarily the best designation of resources long-term, especially in light of some of the very great work that's come out of Miami-Dade in regards to looking at longer-term sustainability. They did a great job addressing some of the water concerns in that report, and it doesn't seem like they at all looked at some of the existing proposals to see how the track they're on may be divergent from the track that they say they want to be on with their sustainability work.
My sister logged out, but she did add a few things in regards to the utilities and Duke Energy. She says, since Duke Energy bought Progress, we are about to become deregulated. She said, but we're not deregulated yet. And then she said, she added, because they are not allowed to profit. So I'm not sure what she meant by that either. So that's kind of curious. I'll have to ask her and actually post it out on the blog and have you answer it later, because I wanted her to be more specific, and she kind of logged out before she could give us the meat of that.
We'll circle back, and if it's not something I have the answer to, I can get the answer for it if I don't have it. So just definitely let me know, and we'll get that up there for your listeners.
But I wanted to cover just a few other things. We've kind of gone around the state in regards to Florida and covered Florida. What were some of the dangers of nuclear energy and some of the power plants that were affected by Hurricane Sandy? Because I know when that was occurring, when the storm was on its way, there were some really, really big concerns about the aftermath in regards to the power plants up in that part of the United States.
Sandy definitely had some impact. Last summer, the floods in Iowa had serious impact on Fort Calhoun, which is still not operating again after those floods. The earthquake
in
Virginia had some serious impact. So what we've seen is a series of increasingly serious events that have been going on. Floods, tornadoes. There were a series of tornadoes last year that knocked out power to reactors or knocked them offline, made them go into auto shutdown. And the thing I think to take into consideration is it doesn't matter what the storm is or where it is. If there's a nuclear reactor in the path of it and you're expecting flooding or down electric lines, these are all problems that could have serious safety implications at a nuclear reactor. Nuclear power is the only energy source that requires a backup energy to maintain safety. So they have to have an off-site power generating source to make sure that it stays safe. And, of course, on-site they rely on diesel generators and all of this kind of stuff. But right now we're in the midst of sort of learning what we can from what happened at Fukushima. And so the regulatory bodies are going through the process now to determine what we can do in the United States to make sure that something like that doesn't happen. But what they found out when they were doing their initial assessment is that a lot of the regulations are sort of like voluntary initiatives, and so the operators sort of get some choice as to how they respond to certain things. And so what they found is that the ability for reactors to cope with what they call a prolonged station blackout, it varies from site to site. Some sites it's 3 hours, some sites it's 8 hours, and so they're wanting to bring it up to a standard for all of the sites so that they can make sure that these things can stay safe if something like that happens where the off-site power is taken down. But the main thing I think to take away is that what happened in Japan at Fukushima definitely should be a wake-up call to the United States. The big thing that is a takeaway for me is that it just showed that human error is a factor that you can't exclude from the equation, no matter how good the science is. And the science wasn't good for Fukushima. There's a lot of stuff that's come to light that has shown that they knew that this could happen. And the same sort of thing happens here, at the North Anna reactor in Virginia. We had that big earthquake that happened, the East Coast earthquake, sort of surprised a lot of people. We didn't expect it wasn't a serious earthquake, but it was a higher magnitude than is generally predicted for that area. So we see this increase in seismic activity going on all over the place. How can we really plan for these things long term when you're looking at not only the 60 years, the 40 years of the initial license, the 20 years of the relicense, and then the hundreds and hundreds of years that the waste will be around after the reactors are no longer operating? How is it that we can plan so far ahead to know that there's always going to be power there to keep the cooling water circulating around so that a criticality doesn't occur? That's putting a lot of faith into a future that has too many question marks, It's a little disconcerting, to say the least.
My biggest fear, I think, after going to the teach-in where I first met you, was the gentleman that got up to speak about the cooling pools at Crystal River and how short they were, and if there had been a storm surge, the water definitely would have gone over the containment walls into the the rod cooling pools. And that concerned me greatly, because I thought that could happen so easily after a hurricane, during a hurricane, just with the normal amount of storm surge. And it seems like the Big Bend of Florida is pretty much always under the firing line if we have any kind of storm in the Gulf region. So what's your take on that? How easy could that happen? Is it a likelihood?
I don't know as much about storm surge and how that, obviously that could knock out the power, and that's always a problem, because you have to have power at a nuclear reactor to keep it safe. But I can say that our waste problem hasn't gotten any better, and most of the pools that are at operating reactors are packed way beyond the initial design basis. And the reason is because they never found a solution for the waste. And as I alluded to before, the NRC recently overturned its own decision. They had like this what they called the waste confidence rule. They basically said, oh, we'll figure it out. And they never figured it out, and so now they're having to go back to the drawing board, and they've got 2 years to come up with a new rule regarding waste before they're going to be able to do any licensing activities. And so there will be no new licenses and no license extensions while they're looking at that. But it's definitely a concern that we should all be paying a lot more attention to, because these reactors have been operating, some of them, for 20, 30 years already. They're getting close to the end of their 40 years, and the fuel pools are full in a lot of cases. They're just packing these spent fuel rods in tighter and tighter because they don't have anywhere else to put them. Yeah, that's it's worrisome.
We're going into 6 minutes left on the show, or on your interview, because I do want to play Dr. Helen Caldicott for the second hour, half hour. I'm looking for a particular video of hers that was really quite brilliant, and it was the latest update that she did. But give us a little rundown on what we need to do as citizens in regard to being aware and activism and who we need to be contacting and just what we need to be doing to move forward to let our leaders know that this is none of this is acceptable. It's just not.
I agree. And we have often have opportunities for direct action, for writing letters. We have different campaigns going on at different times depending upon what's happening at the legislature or at the Public Service Commission. So people can check our website, which is www.cleanenergy.org. We also have some community members are working on a website that's called Stop Nuclear Tax. It's www.stopnucleartax.com, and they have some different action opportunities available there sometimes. Right now, I think that the best thing that folks can do is contact their legislators. There's a lot of new people in office. There are people that were just reelected, and so it's time to start holding those leaders accountable for the things that matter to us. And I think that our energy future is definitely worth giving them a call about and letting them know this stop nuclear tax deal is a bad deal for the customers, and that we really need to work to get a renewable portfolio standard in our state so we can start looking for real solutions on energy for Florida's future.
How can people get in touch with you and SACE, and how can they get a message through to you? And they can just go to the SACE website and sign up for a newsletter.
We do have the cleanenergy.org website has a place you can sign up for a newsletter, and we also have a listserv that is specifically for Florida-related stuff that I moderate. And if folks want to get in touch with me to join that list, or if they have questions on how they can get involved in what's happening in Florida, they can feel free to shoot me an email. It's my name, Mandy, M-A-N-D-Y, at cleanenergy.org.
Okay, and is there any parting words that you have for us in regards to solar energy and making our leaders focus, or trying to get our leaders to focus on that?
Well, we don't have much of a choice. Our time is running out, and I think that we just sound silly calling ourselves the Sunshine State with so little solar on our roofs. And if Germany can meet a lot of its power through distributed rooftop solar, I think that Florida has a lot of work it can do because Florida is a lot sunnier than Germany is. And I think that our leaders should make sure that they're not picking winners and losers when it comes to our energy future. The way it stands right now, nuclear is it's getting all the chips. It's getting all the attention because of this unfair legislation. And if the playing field were leveled, I think that renewables and efficiency would take us a lot further in a lot cleaner, safer way than all of this nuclear mess.
Well, Mandy, I want to thank you very much for being on the show and filling us in on all this valuable information. And really, when we look at our leaders, we know they're not working for us any longer. And I really do believe, I'm sincere in this, that change has to come from the bottom and go to the top, because we already know it's not going to come from the top and come back down to us.
So that's why we do what we do.
Yeah, it's really up to we the people. So I would encourage everybody to get in touch with Mandy, go to cleanenergy.org. Sign up for the newsletter, get involved, and if you can't go out and actually hold a sign, you can be an armchair warrior, you can write letters to the editor, you can get on call-in programs. There's lots and lots of things you can do just from sitting right at your computer. So I encourage everybody to do that. Write your legislators. Don't stop. Don't give up. But, Mandy, thank you so much. And we will definitely love to have you on again at some point, especially if we need a real concise update on what's happening with the nuclear reactors here in Florida.
So, just let me know. I'd be happy to. Thanks for having me, Anita. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Mandy. You have a good
one. All right. You too. Thanks. Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye. And that was Mandy, and she is from SACE, which is the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. She is the high-risk energy organizer, Mandy Hancock. So really, really great and valuable information. I'm going to spend our last hour replaying an audio from